Dr. Les Olelaw for 50 years has been unashamed of Jesus Christ. He's been serving him faithfully 50 years. He and Charlene together, wonderful team, raised up of God. For many years at the Calvary Baptist Church in New York, in Detroit, Roseville. Many years as an evangelist with a gospel team of young people. And then for some 40 years as a Christian college administrator at Northland. An indomitable, unstoppable, unflappable, what you see is what you get, servant of the Lord. He's a converted lumberjack. He's a hockey player. He's a lover of young people, who understands young people, who talks their language, and a man who is able to cut through by the gifts that God has given him, cut through to the chase of whatever the issue is, and to deal with it with humor and with scriptural understanding. He's one of a kind. The Lord never made another one like him. And I hope the Lord leaves him around for a long, long time, because he's needed for the cause of Christ. When he knows what's right, he will do what's right. You can always count on him when he knows what's right to do what's right. And he's unashamed of doing right. Sometimes we go through life not knowing what is right. Lord, show us the position we should take. Show us what is right. Things aren't always black and white. And when he understands what the Lord is saying and doing, he's on the Lord's side every time. And I like to be on the side of a man like that. So he's going to be our preacher twice this week.
I want to say thanks for this very humbling opportunity. I'll say more on Friday night. Let's turn to Psalm 77. I want to set a premise with the question, what do I do when normal is gone? What do I do when normal is gone? And I think one thing I love about the Asaphian Psalms is the psalmist does not hesitate to express his feelings to God about the deep hurts. During the last several years of our ministry, as Charlene and I have traveled, been in many, many local churches, and we've noticed a lot of people sit in church, nicely dressed, appropriately smiling, but hearts that are aching, souls deeply troubled, because the sweet memories of what used to be are overshadowed by the troubling present circumstances. And I could illustrate that in many ways. Bitterness and subtle anger at God begin to occupy their minds instead of the sweet songs that used to be their experience. What do I do when normal is gone? The present and the past are two different worlds. We struggle with being honest about feelings because of fear of rejection by other Christians, or that we have to face less than a perfect image. You know, God has his own way of showing himself mighty. I define brokenness as the shattering of my will so that my every response is controlled by the Holy Spirit of God. Anything that makes me dependent is good for me. We long to be independent. We long to be in control, but God, in shaping us into his image, has his own way of squeezing us that we might be driven to him. As I studied Psalm 77, you cannot ignore Charles Haddon Spurgeon. But it's interesting that he wrote his commentaries on the Psalms between 1865 and 1885. In those 20 years, Spurgeon experienced poor health, which continued to his death. Neuralgia, gout, left him with swollen, red, painful limbs so that he often could not walk or even write. Debilitating headaches added to these other ills, and as Spurgeon himself said, led to frightful bouts of depression, which left him nearly in despair. Have you ever been there? He left London for warmer climate of southern France, where he made his departure to his eternal home from there. And in commentating on Psalm 77, Spurgeon said, "Some of us know what it is to both be physically and spiritually compelled to use these words. No respite has been afforded by the silence of the night. Our bed has been a rack to us. Our body has been in torment, our soul in anguish." And he says, "Alas, this author," i.e. Spurgeon, "knows the deep glooms and glens and lonely caves of soul depression. My spirit knows full well your awful glooms," referring to Asaph in this psalm. What do we do when normal is gone? My wife and I were doing a revival meeting in a church. We had been there before. I noticed when I finished my Sunday night service, I preached on the topic of bitterness. And the reason I began doing that at least one time in these 3 or 4 day or 7 day meetings is because I have noticed that many people sitting in church are angry at God, and that anger begins to seethe and eventually spurts out in bitterness. And yet we go on with the mask and we go on with the pretense. And I noticed when I was coming to the end of this message, a lady who was the pianist, very faithful family in that church, she was over to the right. She got out of the seat and went to her knees on the steps weeping right during the service. This was not a church where people would just get in and run around. This was a church that was pretty much under control in the emotion. But she was weeping there. So I went to her afterwards and I said, "I don't know what's on your soul, but God cares." Monday night, she came and handed me this typed dissertation. And she said, "I came into this conference with a chip on my shoulder. I was braced for hurt, ready to lash out when you began speaking about the blessing of children. I had some choice questions ready for God when that topic came up. I knew there was no way I would make it through 6 messages without hearing something that would stir these feelings of anger inside me." And then she goes and tells her story after several years of prayer and attempting. They were not able to have children. She said, "I don't know how to exactly summarize for you the pain and, yes, anger that has been building inside me. I've struggled to share in friends' joy as they have children. I've begged God to help me accept His decision. But at the same time, I've wanted to hurt. I have felt a right to be upset, to feel cheated. Simply put, I wallowed in my feeling. I've known I was angry. I said I didn't want to be, but continued to let myself slosh around in feeling badly for myself. When I listened to the Bible tonight, I shuddered at what it was uncovering. I let myself believe I was just angry over not having a baby. But I saw tonight anger had gotten a hold of me, maybe before this, maybe after, it doesn't matter. Things have been rough at work," she wrote for one of the large newspapers. "Everyone's complaining. I've joined right in. Hey, I said to myself, this really isn't right. It's okay to be angry with everyone else about something that isn't right. I would jump right in with complainers. I see how anger spills out of me when no one else around to see. I growl. Yes, growl out loud if I'm driving and someone cuts me off. If my husband isn't around, I see something of his that needs to be picked up. I do it with a heavy, exaggerated sigh. I know I've hurt my husband too, snapping at him in ugly ways to oversimplify things. I recognize myself in that sarcastic description of Moses. Near the end of the message, you quoted the verse, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. I could not stop the tears, and that's when she burst out of her seat and went to her knees on the platform steps. Why can't I trust the God who saved me, the God of the universe, to handle my problem? Why can't I trust that he is in charge, regardless of how bleak my situation? And then she goes on to say how she got right with people at work, went back and got right with her husband. And she said, I've rambled long enough. I hope this makes sense. But she found a freedom. She said, I want to rest in the care of my Savior. I have found freedom. But yet that woman was one of the most appreciated women in that church. And yet, who had the idea that within her soul was this wrestling? You know, you might be in that circumstance. Well, if God is who God claims to be, why does he let this happen? Why doesn't he show up? I was doing a conference out in California, or in Teton Mountains, a snowmobile retreat, 100 men. A man who owned a construction company came to me and he said, I paid a man to come to the retreat. I paid his 2 days of work and I paid his admission fee, but he is not saved. And as I preached, I would look over and I would watch Bill as the message. He would look down. He had no response. He always sat right against the back wall of that chapel. And then the time before the last closing session, when we had to head back on the snowmobiles back onto the main highway, this man who owned the construction company came and said, I saw Bill writing a lot while you were preaching that last session. He wants to talk to you. And so he didn't come to me, so I went and found him before my last session, and I put a chair in front of him, and I said, Bill, I'm so humbled to be able to be preaching to you. He said, I said, I heard you want to talk to me. He said, I do, but I don't want to hurt your feelings. I disagree with your whole premise. He said, you said last night we were sinners. He said, no, God is a sinner. And he shoved this paper in my face. He said, put that in your anger file. He said, what do you say to a man who watched his mother suffer from a 40-foot fall? I was 5 years old. Watched his father die from brain tumor. I was 7. Watched his sister become a heroin addict. I was 10. Saw his puppy get hit by a car and die. I was 13. Who prayed that I would never see my grandfather suffer. I walked in and the paramedics were doing CPR and died. And who thinks that God is a sinner? And there's much more. Who prayed that his mom would not suffer. To take her years before he did not, she suffered. And I suffered watching her suffer. Whose nephew died at 30 years old. And there is more. Thanks for your time, Dr. Les. And he signs his name on the bottom. And I said, Bill, you realize God's not angry at you? The only one who has an answer to that angst, the only one who has an answer to the bitterness that you have faced in life, is the one who suffered every single thing. I said, when he was on the cross and in that 3 hours of darkness, the full wrath of God was poured out, called propitiation. And I said, so Bill, you would never have to know eternal damnation. I said, I can see your pain. But you know, many believers are feeling that way. Why can't God answer prayer? Why are things the way they are? And I want us to look now in Psalm 77 and look through, like skipping a rock across water. This will be a touching on this chapter. The psalmist says, I cried unto God with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My soul ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. In other words, pause and think on this. Thou holdest mine eyes waking. I am so troubled I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I commune with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah. And so we see the first section of this psalm. We see the psalmist pouring out his heart in the pain that is coming from his soul. There are three sections of this psalm, and I'm going to deal primarily with two. The symptoms and solutions of depression. What were some of the symptoms of depression in this Asaphian psalm? What were some of the things that stood out to him? Number one, we see an uncomforted soul. He said, my soul refused to be comforted. Have you ever been troubled about something and you could not get that off your mind? It was there. And then overwhelmed spirit. Verse 3, I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Then he said, stop and think on that. You ever felt that way? Overwhelmed. You say, I can't handle any more of this. And then troubled sleep. Verse 4, behold mine eyes waking. Go to bed and just cannot sleep. It doesn't matter how much time you have. You can't sleep. You toss and you turn and you get up and have a snack and you go back and lay down. And then verse 4, silent. Speech. It's silenced. So troubled, I can't talk. And I like what David said in Psalm 39, because David, in one of his psalms, was pouring out his heart in the same way. And he said, God, put a guard about my lips when the wicked is present. You know, I used to glance over that and look at that and say, well, David, being careful how you talk. David said, I had to be careful that I didn't accuse my God in front of the wicked. He said, God, you put a guard about my lips so that the wicked could never get a hint of what I am feeling right now about you. Silent in speech. Then he said, a diligent search, verse 6. I commune with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. And we find that here was this man of God crying out to his God. He knew in his mind that his God was there. He knew in his mind that his God was right. But in this particular situation, he could not accept a settled heart that God was indeed the one who is in control. So we see the symptoms of an uncomforted soul and an overwhelmed spirit and troubled sleep and silenced speech and diligent search that was going on. What is God doing in all of this? I went to my nephew's place out in Seattle, the president of a large corporation out of Calgary. His son was killed in an accident. They were diving off of a bridge during their construction break, hit by a train. When they were trying to run off the trestle, they were diving into the water, and they got hit by a train. I flew out. My nephew, who wanted me to be with the corporate executives and there in the front, and he preached half the message. And he made this statement about the death of his son: God knows that I don't, but I will hold fast to his unchanging and immense attributes. You know, Habakkuk cried out, God, how long? God, how long? And the answer that Habakkuk found was turning to the attributes of God. We become like our emotional focus. I remember meeting with freshmen that would come in to Northland. The first 2 weeks at 7 in the morning, I would meet with freshmen, and I was helping them to begin building a biography of God. I said, the thing you know that will stand you good is to know your God. In fact, a pastor asked me one time after he dropped his child off, he said, what do you see as the greatest need of incoming freshmen to Christian college? I said, the biggest need is that they know God. Not just know about him, but know him. Not just know him in salvation, but that they know him in his attributes. And I appreciate the message that was preached last night, the magnification of Christ, and I appreciate what Dr. Harding preached about true believers. We had so many students saved in their freshman year. And I used to tell youth workers at Youth Workers Conference, make sure you're dealing with born-again young people. I said, you try to get a goat to act like a sheep, you will look like a donkey trying to make it happen. And boy, if you've ever worked in that realm, you will understand exactly what I'm saying. And so we would have them start building a personal biography of God. I said, why? Because you haven't hit the wall yet. I said, you're freshmen, you've come from mostly good homes. Some of you have hard backgrounds like we had. But most of you came from good homes, Christian parents. You've never really had a need. Oh, maybe you flunked a test or something and you thought the world was coming to an end because my image is shot and Dad's going to kill me. But I said, what are you going to do when you hit the wall? Don't doubt in darkness what God has revealed to you here in light. And I said, you get your anchor in the attributes of God. And I said, when you hit the wall, you will have something to anchor your soul, or you will get blown out of the water. We become like our emotional focus. And what's happening in this psalm is we're about to go after that Selah. We are about to go into a shift where there is a pivot point. And verses 10, 11, and 12 are like a pivot point that gets me from here to here. For example, if I develop a contempt for someone or something, I concentrate on that person or that thing. I conform to that person or that thing. And I literally am controlled by someone for whom I have contempt. And a third party sees it, but you're just like that. I said, but it works the other way too. Compassion for him, according to Hebrews 12, looking unto Jesus, away from everything else, singly to him. Compassion for him leads to concentration on him, conformity to him, controlled by him, and a third party can see it. I can't believe how Christ-like you are in this. What is the difference? Your focus is the difference. You know, many times God allows us to get into situations and circumstances because we get so impressed with us. We get so impressed with ourselves that God says, you know, I'm not really being magnified here. And God allows trials, situations to turn our focus to him. David experienced this many times. We see this same circumstance in so many other lives. And so now we see in verse 10, and I said, this is my infirmity, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. So the right hand is always showing the power of God. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember thy wonders of old. I will meditate of thy work and talk of thy doings. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? And you notice in verses 1 through 6, there are 18 personal pronouns, I, me, my, 18 times and 6 God references in the first 6 verses. Now the pivot begins to take place. And at the end, there are 21 verses, 13 through 20, 21 references to God and only a hint of a reference to self. And I think one of the things you need to do as a student, I need to do, I'm as old as dirt and I still need to focus. I said, God is still shaping his character in me. What are the solutions? We've seen the symptoms. What are the solutions? Well, number one, remember the works of God. Verse 11, I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember the wonders of old. So we remember the works of God. What are they doing? They're going back now to God's deliverances and how God worked in the past. When David came against Goliath, an impossible situation. Saul said, you cannot go. You're but a youth. He said, oh, when I was tending my father's sheep, a lion came. He said, killed a lion. A bear came and I killed a bear. This ungodly Philistine is no match for my God. Because David didn't see a big giant, he saw a big God. Because while he was tending sheep, he would look up into the starry heavens and magnify and worship the character of his God. That's why I think while you students, to keep a journal of the works of God. I remember when Charlene and I were down at Bootleg Corner here in Greenville. We helped in the church plant there with Rod Bell. And then when we, for a brief time, were part of the leadership there, we lived from hand to mouth. We started keeping a journal of the works of God from the time God brought Charlene into my life 52 years ago. And we've been married 100 years now. She's been married 50. I've been married 50. We started journaling the works of God. I told her one morning, I said, honey, write everything, put it into the offering, what was in the check. You said, your wife writes the checks. Yes, that's why I'm not in prison. If that doesn't make me a man, then I'm not a man. But at least we're not broke. And she said, well, that's all there is left. And she wasn't arguing. She was just reporting. Ever go to God and say, I'm not challenging God. I'm just reporting. Well, that afternoon, I got a phone call. Somebody said, how are your finances? I said, they're okay. He said, I bought a new car. Do you want the one I have? And I said, yeah, we'll take that. And we sold a car we were driving at that time for $850. And then I got a check in the mail a couple of days later for $150. So we are $1,000 richer. Now that goes back to when $1,000 was. Because in that era, I think room, board, and tuition at Bob Jones is $930. So you make the comparison. Now the university is getting rich and you're broke. Hardy har har. Another time we were out of groceries, knock comes at the door. Open the door. We lived there behind the old, in that white house behind the first new building that was, no, Mount Calvary. And he said, "Are you Les Ola?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, God told me to come here with food." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "That's not the issue. God told me to come. Fill the kitchen table up with food." I never saw that guy before, never saw him afterwards. Wasn't an angel driving a Volkswagen. Thought heaven's not that bad off. But you know, from that point on, it was the good hand of God. And you know what? When you start recording the works of God and the wonders of God, you know what happens when you hit the wall? Your mind goes back. Say, yes, God can do it again, but right now my heart is so heavy, I don't know that I can handle another thing on me. But those attributes will pull you through the wonders of God. I will remember the works of the Lord. I surely will remember thy wonders. And then he, in verse 13, focus on the worship of God. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. So we see the holiness of God. In Psalm 73, another Asaphian psalm, Asaph again is honest. He said, "God, I've made myself righteous in vain. I look at the wicked. They are in prosperity. They have everything. There's fatness in their eyes. There's no fear in their death. I have made myself righteous in vain." The world has it made. Everybody I know who knows you is losing. "Until I went into the sanctuary of God and I considered their end." You see the shift? It was there, pivot, there. And he said, "I saw that they were on slippery places, heading for hell." What did he do? He found his rejoicing in the worship of God. What did Moses cry in Exodus 33? "God, show me your way and show me your glory." Because God had called Moses to do something. Moses said, "I can't." God says, "I am that I am." Don't say "I can't" when "I am that I am" calls you to do something. We learn a lesson. Anything that makes us dependent is good for us. You know, that's when we have to start focusing that God is in control of all things. Remember about 27 years ago, we had two very heavy-hearted situations. That time our son Stephen was, I'm guessing, about 7 years old. I'm somewhere in there, seven or maybe a little bit younger, and he was at one of our staff members' homes, and he was showing him this knife collection. I was away on a trip, and Ernie had taken some of the knife. One of the knives slipped and just clipped Stephen just on the wrist. And he went over and told Charlene that it's a little cut. Maybe, I don't know if we had to take him up in the hospital or not. And so Charlene drove him up, and then I got home, I think that night or the next morning. And Stephen calls from school. He said, "Dad, pick me up. I'm not well." I said, "Stephen, you're getting a lot of mileage out of that little cut. You're not coming home." So we stayed the day. The driver came in. The kids were dropped off. We would carpool. And normally Stephen would get out of the car, flip over the swing set and flip over the door and flip over the couch. And then he'd flip into the kitchen. And, well, he dragged out, dragged and sat, and I pulled that bandage off from the hospital, and it was all oozing. So we were in, long story short, 21 days. I called it solitary confinement. I didn't know what the hospitals call that. But we had to go in with masks and things, and doctors said, "You know, if I don't know what that is, but if it gets out of there, we're going to lose his hand. If it gets out of there, we're going to lose his arm. And if it gets out of the arm, we're going to lose him." So Charlene would spend days there, and I would spend nights there. And At the same time, we were going through a very heart-wrenching situation. I would go down to the hospital. There was nobody in the cafeteria. There was a coffee machine down there, and I would go down to get coffee. And I remember, had my Bible, and I'd preached for 20 years. And everything, give thanks, rejoice in the Lord. I said, God, I will not thank you for this. This is not your will. And I will not thank you for this. And I wrestled Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Friday, I gave up. I said, God, I'm letting you control. And fortunately, Charlene and I don't own a reputation. We gave that away on the altar years and years ago. Our only identity is who we are in Christ. We don't own a reputation. You get in circumstances like this sometimes, you say, God, what are you doing? And you know what I discovered? I went to Wednesday night prayer meeting one night, and one of our very faithful staff members came out. The wife came out and said, you need to talk to my husband. He's not coming to church tonight. I said, what's the problem? She said, I don't know. I said, where is he now? She said, out in the car sleeping. So I went out and looked through the parking lot of the church there at Faith Baptist in Beecher, and I found the car, and I rapped on the window, and he was had the seat reclined sleeping. And he sat up and rolled the window down, and I said, what's happening? He said, I don't like what I do anymore. I said, what does that have to do with anything? I said, I haven't liked what I've done for the last 20 years. I said, you know what God did in me? The first 20 years of my ministry, everything was exciting, messages, studying, travel, counseling, youth ministry, seeing this and seeing. I said, you know what happened? I was loving the ministry and winking at my master. And I said, God in his perfect love put me in his vice, and he squeezed. And he squeezed. And he was squeezing less out and squeezing him in. And I said, you know what? A pivot, a transfer took place. I don't know when. But I know now I love the master and I do his ministry, 90% of which is not pleasant. 10% function like this is fine. But that's not the ministry. 90% is unpleasant labor. Sweat. Hard work. Who said we have to like everything that we do? We need to love him and do his work. This is warfare. How many people, our grandson was in Afghanistan, had a 14-month deployment. I don't think they ever went out. And as they were getting blasted in firefights and these things, said, man, I love this, don't you? I don't want to rest. I hate rest. No, when you're intense, when you are in the midst of it all, this is warfare. Our rest is yet coming. I talked to him the next day. He came, he said, you know, Les, that's exactly what was going on in my life. I had all the experiences I wanted. Now I needed to move on to something meaningful. Boy, did I love Dr. Priest the other morning when he gave us the challenge. It's about dying, not about us living. But oh, what a needed challenge that is. And I said, Lord, I thank you. Because my goal in life, I had written in the corner of my devotional journal years ago, that I might know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering. Philippians 3. It's easy to write down. You're willing to pay the price and to keep on plowing. And as we look at the shaping of a Christ-like character into us, we say, Lord, thank you for what we cannot handle because we let you, God, be in charge. And out of that, I developed a counseling plan for myself. What do you do when normal is gone? Very similar to this Asaphian move here. What do you do when the phone rings and the message is not good? Number one, acknowledge this indeed is true. This is not a dream. This is true. Or maybe if a loved one is lost, for a week maybe you say, well, you hear the car pull, oh, he's back. Or she's back. Or the room is, oh, he's back. No. Finally, acknowledge this is true. That's the easy part. The next step, accept it. And you know what accepting is? Accepting is completely trusting our sovereign God. I remember what John McCormick used to say, has it ever occurred to you that nothing has ever occurred to God? But accepting means stand still and see the salvation of God. I'm working on a message right now called Be Still and Know That I Am God. But you know, being still, as Moses had to be at the Red Sea, and we find the analogies ending with this passage of Moses and God's miraculous works. As the waters were driven back, be still and know that I am God. We want to wrestle. We want to take charge. Control freaks have a very hard time with this. Control freaks want to control everything. Narcissists cannot handle an X-ray of the heart. If I can't control it, I will not accept it. I said, so you accept it. This indeed is true. And God, I completely trust you in this. Thirdly, adapt to it. Normal is gone. Create a new normal and make a ministry out of that new normal. This is what Charlene and I did. We didn't try to hide. To this day, I get calls from people I don't know from Adam's house cat. I get them calls from overseas. Les, I know you went through this circumstance. I know you went through that situation. And how did you deal with this? And we have a ministry that we've had for the last 27 years in giving heart and counsel to people. And you say, well, you don't know what I went through. No, what God allows in you is the very thing, because you have to make a new normal and make a ministry out of that new normal. Because normal ain't coming back. How are you going to handle it? If you don't accept it, you're going to die bitter. And you will never adapt. You will go in refusal till the day of your death. Or you can make a ministry, because there are millions of hurting people sitting in churches like we sit every Sunday. But you don't know what hurt is going on in their hearts. Our Christian family ought to be a place where we can hurt out loud without rejection and be encircled by people who themselves have their own personal issues. So then you adapt. You know, you will not believe how many opportunities, how many situations, and people will begin to uncover, say, I didn't know that, because people perceive those in Christian service or people who run an institution like this have never faced an issue, never faced a problem, perfect families, perfect this, perfect that. No, we have an enemy. One of the burdens I have is lifting the arms and strengthening the hearts of people who have a target on them. And you young people, get braced. If you're going to go into attack the kingdom of darkness with the truth of the gospel, there's never been an exception that there's been warfare. But greater is he in us than he that's in the world. And fourthly, you accelerate. Forgetting that which is behind, pressing forth unto that which is before. Paul says, I press to the mark of the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. One of the keys to your success will be a bad memory and good vision. What if Paul meditated on his past, having Christians arrested, stoning Stephen, forcing in his testimony before Agrippa? He said, Agrippa, you know, I forced Christians to blaspheme. Paul says, forgetting that, pressing forth. We cannot look back either at blessings or at problems. We must look forward. And so we see, focusing on the worship of God. And then last of all, consider the ways of God. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. And then in verse 19, thy way, O God, is in the sea. And then verse 17, his way is in the skies. God has his way, and as God opened the sea for Moses to pass through, and the children of Israel, and God showed himself mighty in the sanctuary, showed himself mighty in the sea, even in the storms, where he would win battles from the sky. All God wants us to do is rest and trust him. Let him finish his work in us. Moses said, God, show me your glory. Well, look at Job. God himself said he's a man who feared God and eschews evil. And yet, when his friends came along and made accusations and made these false premise statements, Job began to argue, and God gave Job a pop quiz, saying, oh, if you're so wise, where were you when I spoke the worlds into existence? Job said, I have heard of thee with the hearing of my ear. Now mine eye seeth thee. I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. Job had to come to a point of just broken as God, you are in control. And you know what I love in Job 42:12? The latter end of Job was better than the first. You know, when we get through these fires, one thing I'm excited for Bob Jones University. Bob Jones University is in a test right now. But it's a good test. You know why? Because the latter end is going to be better than the former. If we just respond as God would have us to respond, that God, you are in control. Dr. Bob said the other night, we don't have a foundation or we don't have good. You know the places that I know have these humongous foundations? You know what they imply? We don't need anybody. So we can tell you off if we want to. You know what institutions like we used to have at Northland and what is here? People fall on their faces before God, say, God, all we have is you. And then God says, that's what I like. Let me show myself mighty. We've created a mess in our movement, in our fellowships. Who's running things? Who's in charge? Isaiah, the great prophet of God. He says, in the year that King Uzziah died, after this great leader had been the focus, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord. I like that word also. Then the seraphim cried, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts. And Isaiah said, I am undone. He got to the I am level like Job did. I am undone. new concept of God. He got a new concept of sin. He got a new concept of himself. Got a new purging, and he got a new commission. Here am I. That's location. Send me. That's locomotion. Jesus was trying to get to Peter. Said, Peter, I know what you are. You don't know what you are. And finally, Peter says, depart from me, Lord. I am a sinful man. And what God has wanted to do in us is bring us down to that I am level. God said, you are great. God is great. I am nothing except by his grace. And we need to let him finish his work in us. You know, ultimately, when you look at Romans chapter 8, greatest chapter on security in the Bible, starts with no condemnation, ends with no separation. Right in the middle of that chapter is suffering. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them called according to his purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he did predestinate that we might be conformed to the image of his dear Son, the firstborn of many who would become just like him. He was the firstborn as a model for us. How does it happen? Through suffering. So don't ever resent the times when you're driven to your knees and you fall on your face before God and say, God, show yourself mighty that we might love you and obey you and be dependent on you and let your name be magnified. I forget who it was in the past that said, let my name rot, but let him be magnified. May God give us a passion for him and a love for him. May God use us. And again, as I said, it's like skipping a rock over this psalm because I used a lot of personal illustration and application. But I think if we just say, Lord, do something that only you can get the glory for as it's done, that we might see his name magnified.